Case 46 in the Heikigan Roku. Shosei's Voice of the Raindrops. Engo's introduction. In a single action, he transcends both the ordinary and the holy. With a single word, he cuts away all complications and encumbrances. He walks the ridge of an iceberg. He treads the edge of a sword. Seated amid the totality of form and sound, he rises above them. Leaving aside the freedom of such subtle activity, tell me, what about finishing it in a moment? See the following. Main subject. Kyosei asked a monk, what is the noise outside? The monk said, that is the voice of the raindrops. Kyosei said, men's thinking is upside down. Deluded by their own selves, they pursue things. The monk said, what about yourself? Kyosei said, I was near it, but I'm not deluded. The monk asked, what do you mean by near it but not deluded? Kyosei said, to say it in the sphere of realization may be easy, but to say it in the sphere of transcendence is difficult. Secho's verse, the empty hall resounds with the voice of the raindrops. Even a master fails to answer. If you say you have turned the current, you have no true understanding. Understanding? No understanding? Misty with rain, the northern and southern mountains. I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning on this beautiful autumn morning. I hope you had a very nice sit this morning. For me, it was really wonderful. I've had a lot of pressures lately in my personal life, in my professional life, and so on. They can add up, you know. So some of you have been following the problems with the state economy. And it's not just Rutgers, but universities all over the country are going through a lot of difficulties. And I hope it's over, but it might not be. I was reading the other day that the California state system had cut 20% of their budget. So the California state system, that's all the state colleges and universities, including like UC Berkeley, had their budgets cut by 20%. And that's on top of several other 20% reductions. So that's really a lot of money. You know, if somebody took 20% of your income, you can imagine how that would feel, especially if they'd already taken on two other occasions 20%. So that's scary for anybody in universities. And New Jersey also has seen several rounds of cuts. I run a program here at Rutgers that handles quite a few students, at like 12,000 students. I don't do it by myself, you know. But it's a big program, and it has a lot of resources. And I was very much afraid that it was going to be demolished. You know, I have a personal investment in this because when I came here, the program was quite a bit smaller. And it really was very different. And I've worked really hard over more than 20 years to build it up and make it something really special. And I think I've been pretty successful. And I think it's worked out pretty well. So I was worried that all of this was going to be destroyed And many people laid off. You know, a lot of people in the writing program have been working there for years. People who work there for 10 or 15 years. And they've kind of made it their home. They've put their, built their professional lives around this project. And, you know, they have bills to pay and mortgages to pay. They have children, you know. And so, you know, I feel a strong sense of responsibility to take care of these people. A number of years ago, I had to lay off 12 people. And that was really, I mean, I lost a lot of sleep over that because, you know, they were people I knew and had a high regard for, people who had worked very hard every year. You know, these are people who teach a lot of courses. They're not research faculty. They're part-time, they're instructors. And they have a teaching load which is staggering. They teach 7 courses a year. So they teach. And they do a great job. They get these wonderful evaluations and they have a good life, you know. So I kind of feel like it's my responsibility to protect them if I possibly can. And about maybe 10 years ago, I had to quote unquote let go 10 of those people, 12 of those people. And that really bothered me a lot. And over the years, I rehired them all back. They had to go on, they had to work part-time, and that was a real hardship for them. Maybe they lost half their salaries, probably more. And so as soon as I could, I hired them all back, and they're back on their old jobs safely. But it really bothered me, and so, you know, I've been very worried about this. And, you know, fortunately, it's all worked out well, but all the same, you know, it can create a lot of pressure, internal pressure, right? And also, that kind of thing can happen in your personal life, too. I've been, my wife and I have been taking care of her father, my father-in-law. Jack, I've talked about him before. He's the gun lover, and I mentioned that he has a big gun collection. He loves guns. He's a design engineer from he used to work at Sandia Labs, a science lab in New Mexico. And he even though he's a engineer and spent his life with very sophisticated people, he likes to hunt. In his prime, he used to go out and hunt with guns, and he's a gun fancier, so he collects guns. And anyway, he's a very nice man, in spite of his liking all these guns, and I actually love him quite a bit. You know, when I was young, when I got out of college, the only thing I could think about was hiking in the Southwest. I really went out into the, I wanted to get out into the Southwest and do some hiking. And so I took a couple of years off before I went to graduate school. And I did part-time jobs. Also I worked in an Italian restaurant for about a year, trying to save enough money so I could take off a year and just hike with my friend Larry Sullivan. And I did it. My plan succeeded, you know. I met my wife at that Italian restaurant. She was a student, an art student at the University of New Mexico. We hit it off after a while. I was a cook and she was a waitress. And I actually enjoyed being a cook. It was a lot of fun and it was very practical, you know. So you just have to make, you know, cut up the eggplants and that was fun, you know. I had been a good student and I had put a lot of pressure on myself to be a good student. So this was like a vacation, and at the time I wasn't really serious about cooking, you know. But I was interested in learning how to be a good cook, and it was really very fun. I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot, and I learned that I loved to cook, you know. And my day, I would get there early in the morning, and then I'd have to do something like slice up like a whole crate of eggplant. And then you'd have to take eggs and break the eggs up and make a batter with a little milk. And you'd take the eggplant slices and put them in the milk and egg batter, and then you put them in crumbs. And then we had a big fryer filled with olive oil, and you'd fry the eggplants in there. And oh my God, was that good. You know, I'd fry up maybe 25 eggplants. And of course I'd eat some as I was frying them, you know, because they were so good. And fresh, hot, you know, fried eggplant with a little salt on it is heaven, it's heaven. So I would do that, and that was one of my jobs. Or I would make sauce. We would make sauce in a big, big container, like maybe 3 feet tall. And we would make several sauces, you know, and you'd have to be very careful not to let them burn or they'd get a burned flavor. I'd make a manicotti and lasagna. I began to notice this very attractive young woman who later became my wife. And she was nice to me, and she would bring her orders in, and I would cook them up, and there were quite a few waitresses. But she stuck out, and eventually we became friends, you know. I decided not to go back to graduate school that year, but to hang out in Albuquerque for another year. And so I got basically like a postponement of my graduate education. And I was hiking and enjoying the scenery around New Mexico. I met my wife. Finally took me home to meet her parents, you know. And at that time, I really wasn't, you know, I didn't have, you know, any goals. I was just sort of like a goofball, really. I was kind of a goofy hippie, you know. I had long hair. They let me work in the restaurant if I tied my hair back, and I put like a turban on my head so no hair got into the food. So I was always running around with like a turban on, you know, it was really made out of just kitchen cloths. But I had to wrap my whole, tie my hair back and then wrap my whole head in the cloth. And so I looked like a pirate or something, you know. But it worked very well, and there were never any complaints about hair and the food. But when I went over to see my future in-laws, you know, I had long hippie hair. And I had a beard and a mustache. And I probably looked like a bum, you know, really, when I think back on it. And my father-in-law was, he associated with people who were very smart, you know, physicists and things like that. And he must have thought when he met me, oh, brother, you know, what is my daughter doing with this guy? You know? I'm sure he had those thoughts, you know. But anyway, he was very nice to me, you know. I mean, very nice. My wife's family were always very generous people. They didn't ever seem to judge you, you know. They would accept, whenever I would go to their house, they always had guests staying there. And sometimes they were from all over the world, you know. People just seemed so relaxed and easy around my wife's family. I had never known anybody like this, because in my family people were often very tense, you know. And it was such a pleasant atmosphere. Jack, my father-in-law, was so nice to me, even though I was, you know, kind of a hippie bum. And He was just so accepting of who I was, you know, that it was deeply moving. You know, it was like I really liked this family. You know, I thought, yeah, I'd like to be a member of this family. Jack, you know, at that time I had almost no money. I used to make $80 a week, really, if you can believe that. And I eventually got a raise to $120 a week, and I felt like I was fabulously wealthy, you know. And of course, working at the restaurant was good because I could eat all my meals at the restaurant, you know. So I would have my eggplant parmesan for breakfast, and then I would have a piece of manicotti or something for lunch, and part of the deal was that cooks got free meals, and we were there from early in the morning till late at night. You know, it was that kind of thing. When I would go to visit my future wife's family, you know, if we went out to dinner, my father-in-law would always pick up the tab. He'd never let me buy anything. You know, he was so generous. You would almost think he was careless with his money, you know. But he was just a nice guy. He said, "Oh, no, put your wallet back." It was not that I had anything in my wallet, you know. He'd say, "Put that back," you know. And that kind of, it was like he was just the nicest man, and he was also like a rock, you know. He seemed very steady and stable, and things didn't always throw him, you know. Didn't ever seem to throw him, ever. You know, he just seemed very placid and calm. Now he's 89 years old. I say he's 90, it's easier to say, but he's actually 89. And he is, falling apart, and I must say I love him, and you have to kind of keep an eye on him, because just before the last session, he fell down. He has two vodka martinis at 5 o'clock. It's actually interesting to see, because sometimes he'll sleep most of the day, but he'll wake up around 4 and realize it's martini time. And then he'll have a couple vodka martinis and he'll go in and watch CNN television. So anyway, he must have had a couple vodka martinis, and he slipped and fell and hit his head. So, when we came home, he was on the floor. He was unconscious on the floor, like in a pool of blood, you know. And of course, my wife was crying, and this was just a day before Sashin. So we had to take him to JFK, and he turned out, he's okay, you know, he's all right now. But I've had a lot of this stuff on my mind, you know, and a lot of pressures. And it was funny, you know, I've gotten to know my father-in-law even better than I used to. He's told me about his life quite a bit, you know. In certain ways, he's had like a charmed life. You know, he was drafted, I'm not sure, he was in the National Guard. During World War II, all of his friends had said, "Join the National Guard, you won't have to go into the army," you know. So he joined the National Guard, but then they called up his National Guard unit and sent them to war. He survived World War II, you know, amazingly. He got through World War II okay. He came home and he finished college, and then he got this job working for Los Alamos Labs. And then he was later transferred to Sandia Labs. And he worked there for 50-some years. He retired at 70. And it just seems like a charmed life, you know. He's a very talented man. He designed his own house. The house where I first met him, he designed it himself. He didn't build it himself, but he did the plans, the drawings, you know. And it was a beautiful house. He was just a multi-talented person, and he was very much appreciated in his job. They didn't even want him to retire at 70. They kept saying, can't you stay a little longer? You know. But when I got to talk to him, I realized, you know, he too had a lot of stresses. You know, he told me that he had almost quit a couple times out of frustration. And he had an ulcer. And even though they say that ulcers are caused by bacteria, he had a lot of stress problems, you know. And he never showed it, you know, he just seemed so placid and so calm. And somehow he got through it all. But, you know, there's no life where people don't have these kinds of stresses. And you know, I find Zen so wonderful, so important, you know. It helps me enormously to deal with this. You know, part of life is learning how to care about things, being attentive and attached, really, learning how to be attached. So, you know, when I started working in the Italian restaurant, I didn't care at all. It was just a job, you know? I didn't care at all. And I was just trying to make enough money so I could do what I really wanted to do, which was backpacking. And when I first started working in the restaurant, I would make mistakes, you know, and the chef, his name was Bill Garrison, would correct me. And he was a pretty good teacher, you know. But after a while, making mistakes bothered me, you know, bothered me to make mistakes. So I wanted to do a better job. I wanted to be a good cook. And so I began to really try to be a good cook, and I began to really care about things, you know. So, you know, I would cut the eggplant carefully. I'd set it to the right setting, not too thick, not too thin. You know, I'd really make sure there was egg on both sides of the eggplant slice, make sure it's well-breaded, put in the oil. And, you know, I really began to care about these eggplant slices, you know. And I think this is very important, you know, kind of a maturing process. You know, if you think you're not a cook and you think, well, you know, being a cook is trivial. It's really trivial, right? I mean, somebody's got to do it, but it doesn't really matter. That's like an external perspective, like an alienated perspective, right? You're not there. If you're a cook, you know, cooking is your whole life. It's your universe. And that's actually good, you know, that's a good thing. It's a healthy attitude in a way, you know. So if you're going to be a cook, you should be the best cook you can be. And, you know, you should really cut the eggplant carefully. And, you know, things that might have seemed trivial when you weren't in your cook's uniform become very important when you're a cook. You know, so suddenly these eggplants, you know, if you saw a crate of eggplants at the store, you'd think, oh, big deal. But you know, if you're a cook, you look at the eggplants and you think, these are overripe. These won't be good for eggplant parmigiana. Look at these brown spots, you know. And you begin to care about the kind of eggplant you buy. You want to get a case of fresh eggplant. And you know, when you make the sauce, you want to make sure you get the right proportions and you don't put in too much salt or too much oregano or too little. And again, it just seems so trivial. Who cares about eggplants? Who cares about... But when you're really in the moment, if you go to a restaurant and you're trying to have a good time, it's important to you. And when you eat your meal, you know, you're with your friends, you're having the experience of your life at that time, right? I mean, this is what it means to be alive. You're in the moment and you want it to be a good moment. And if somebody has done a good job, if you eat that eggplant parmigiana and you think, oh my God, that is so good, you know, that really enriches your life, you know? It really does. It makes you think, oh, you know, I had the perfect evening. I went out to a restaurant with somebody I care about, and I had the best eggplant parmigiana, right? And then, you know, maybe you have a glass of wine or not, or you know, whatever, and you leave the restaurant and you think, that was a wonderful experience. You know, what a beautiful evening. Somebody's given you a great gift, right? Given you just this great gift. And you don't know who it is, and we don't stop to think about it, but somebody's care and attentiveness made your life better. See, I just think that's wonderful. Somebody's care and attentiveness made your life better. It was like a gift they gave to you. They don't know you and you don't know them, but it's part of being a human being. Anyway, you know, I learned how to be a cook and how to care about cooking. And of course, like anybody else, you know, I got tired sometimes. Sometimes I thought, wow, this is such a hard job, you know, because if you have 100 customers coming into the restaurant all at once, you know, the waitresses are coming in, there's a little wheel where they hang their, they write up the orders, like one, there'll be 3 eggplant, 4 steaks, 3 Parmesan, you know, and they come in and they go, I'm hanging, and they'll tell you what they're hanging, and you stick it in the oven. So you have like a stack of different things in these trays, little metal trays, and you grab like 3 lasagnas and you put them in the oven, 2 manicottis, and then you throw a trout on one burner, and then you throw some steaks on the other burner. And of course, then another waitress comes in, and you know, you're putting stuff in the oven, and you're putting stuff on the burners, the broilers, I should say. And you've got to remember to turn them. And so it gets very complicated. You know, actually, people who are good cooks have very, very good memories. You know, and they remember, you know, they remember all the stuff. They have to focus their minds all night long on all the stuff they have to keep in the oven. And, you know, the worst thing for a waitress is to come in and say, okay, I'm pulling. They come in and they say, I'm hanging first. That means I'm putting in the order. And then they get the customers the salad. They get them some bread. They bring them some wine and so on. Then after a decent interval, they come back in and they say, I'm pulling. And you're supposed to go, uh-oh, here comes your eggplants. Here comes your lasagnas, you know, and you bring them out. And of course, the waitress has to take them all out. Now, what happens if you've forgotten something? You go, oh, wait, I forgot that eggplant. Well, that's murder for the waitress, because then those customers are sitting there thinking, where is our meal? Where is our meal? Okay. And of course, they don't tip the cook. They tip the waitress. So she's not going to get a tip from them, because they think that waitress isn't on the ball. It's taking too long. So she's mad at you. Anyway, the point is, you learn to care. And this is very important part of life, you know. As I say, you know, you could look at being a cook as trivial. You could say, well, you know, it's trivial to be a cook. But really, if a cook does his job well or her job well, it makes your life better. And the whole system works well if people take pride in what they do. And it's not even pride. That's not quite the right word, right? It's you have to give yourself to the moment. You have to give yourself to what you're doing. And if you give yourself wholeheartedly to what you're doing, it becomes this beautiful path, right? So, you know, some of you are going to be some of you are maybe pharmacists, some of you are engineers, some of you are, attorneys, you know, scholars, scientists. And of course, everybody gets a little tired and once in a while a little stale, but when you give yourself wholeheartedly to what you do, everything comes alive and people benefit enormously, you know? So being a cook was a good lesson for me, because if you'd asked me when I was in college, do you think you'd like to be a cook? I would have probably said, a cook? No way, you know? But when I started doing it, I realized this is really a wonderful way of living, wonderful way to be a human being, is to cook for others, you know. So that's really like a miracle, I think, you know. If you're a nurse and you have to take care of other people, you know, at first you might not care, but, you know, you eventually care. You care that the sheets are put on right. You care that they're comfortable and warm. And you care that they're not in distress or in pain. And so caring is part of life. It's really very, very important. And if you don't care, generally speaking, things don't go well, right? I mean, being careless is a problem, you know? If you're not careful, it's not just that things can go wrong and you can get, you can be embarrassed or criticized, or it's that your connection to things isn't as good, you know? You don't feel as alive and as happy. There's a way of being in the flow of things, you know? You go to your job and you have to do things, and you get into the flow, and, you know, sometimes there's obstacles. Sometimes things don't go well. There's problems you have to work through. But even that can be like, you know, that can be engaging. You see, this is part of the of caring, right? So you have to work through the problem and get to the other side, and that's part of caring. You know? So that's really an important aspect of life, and if people care about what they do, it makes a huge difference. It makes life better. And when people don't care, it's always kind of sad, right? When you meet people who just don't care, you know, they're doing something but they're going through the motions. That's a problem. Now there's another aspect to this, though, which is caring too much. Caring too much. This is very complicated, I think, but, you know, you can hold on to things too tightly. Too tightly. You know, if you have to cut the eggplant, you know, sometimes you're not going to cut the eggplant quite right. It's just going to happen, you know. Sometimes the sauce isn't going to come out quite right. And you can let that get you down. You know, you can let that bother you, you know. And it can begin to make your life unhappy and your job unhappy. You know, that's a real problem. So some people, care, like they care too much. You know, you have to care, but if you care too much, you create a rigid mind. You know, a rigid mind. And then transitions become very difficult. You know, very difficult. This seems like a contradiction, and it is kind of a contradiction, right? You have to care, and you have to be engaged and identify with what you're doing. But on the other hand, if you identify too much, right, you create a kind of a wall or rigidity that gets in the way, and it especially becomes obvious when you, in the way you respond to problems, you know? So, you know, if you do anything in this world, you're going to mess up. You're going to make mistakes, and you're going to have problems. And generally speaking, when people have problems, you can see a lot about how they relate to the world, you know? None of us like problems. None of us like them. But there's a way of dealing with problems which is like creative, right? And it's complicated, you know, because it's like you try but you don't try. That seems like a contradiction, right? It's like try but let go. This is sometimes very hard if we invest a lot in something. But in Chinese thinking, there's this concept that I've talked about before, wuwei. Wuwei. You know, in Chuanzi, he talks about butchers, you know, butcher. And he talks about a person who cuts meat. Now, you know, I myself have been a vegetarian for 35 years, but I know that being a butcher is actually, you know, in the West, being a butcher is actually a very skilled field. You know, being a butcher is actually, in the old days, to be a butcher was to be like a very skillful person. You know, butchers were respected because they had a high degree of skill, believe it or not. And this is true in China too. You know, You know, when I myself have actually butchered meat, you know, when I worked in the restaurant, I used to have to slice veal. And I don't believe in eating veal, but at that time I wasn't a vegetarian, and my job was to slice veal, and I would get a big piece of meat. It's a veal is like a calf meat, very soft beef. And I would get this calf meat in a big roll. It was just like a big muscle, actually. And my job was to take this very fine knife and slice the veal quite thin. You know, quite thin, not too thin, or it would be paper thin, which it had to be like about a quarter of an inch. So you have to slice a long piece of meat that's a quarter of an inch. And that takes concentration and skill. And sometimes you screw up, and the knife is incredibly sharp. It's like a razor blade, right? It's a knife that's called a filleting knife, right? And you cut the veal with this knife, and you have to maintain the right thickness as you go through the meat. And it's a challenge, you know. Anyway. I've seen good people just take that knife and they just sail through the meat, right? They just sail through. It's just like, and it's a nice clean cut. In Chuanzi, he talks about butchers who cut meat, and he talks about the fact that, you know, there's different kinds of butchers. There's the butcher who, you know, basically hacks through the meat. You know, the unskillful butcher. And there's a kind of butcher who is very careful and attentive and mindful. And then there's a kind of butcher who cuts between the, basically, he hardly cuts the meat at all. He just cuts between the spaces, basically, between the meat and the bone, you know. So he doesn't touch the bone and he doesn't touch the meat. He just cuts the spaces. Well, this is kind of like a metaphor for how we can act in the world with uwe. If you have to write a chapter for a dissertation, and you think, oh my God, I've got to write this chapter, time is going quickly, blah, 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 you just freak yourself out, right? You know, what you have to do is say, look, I don't care about the outcome, I just want to be in the process. I just want to be present and do my best, no matter what the outcome is. See? The more you think about the outcome, the more paralyzing it can be, you know? And so Zen training is very good because it says the outcome, don't think about the outcome, just be in the moment, right? Just be in the moment. And that's a lot of what we're doing on the cushion. We're learning how not to care about the outcome, but to just be in the moment and let the process unfold. You know, so when you come in to do zazen, you don't know how it's going to go, right? At the end of a meditation period, I go around and say to everybody, "How is your sit?" And everybody's supposed to go, "Great," right? And I hope you do. You know, most people don't go, "Oh, lousy." Sometimes they do, and that's okay. I'm really asking, you know. But the point is, we can't really be sure when we come in to meditate that it's going to be a good sit, no matter what you do. You know, at Sanshin I talked about the fact that baseball players are tremendously superstitious. So, you know, if you hit at the ball and you get a home run, you don't forget, if you're a baseball player, what you did just before that. So, let's say you came up to bat, let's say you came out of the dugout, you tapped the bat on the cleats of your shoe. You took a spit, you know, your spat, because you have tobacco in your mouth or something, chewing tobacco. You pulled you wiped the sweat off your brow, and then you put your cap on tight, right? All of this is just an accident. Then you come up and you clobber the ball, right? Well, baseball players, they think, okay, something made that happen, see? So they next time they go up to the plate, they tap their shoe, right? They wipe their brow, even if there's no sweat. They put the cap on tight. They spit. And they think, oh, I'm supposed to spit first. Now I won't hit it, right? You know? And then they go back and, you know, they don't hit it. And they think, it's because I didn't spit in the right order, you know? So next time they spit in the right order, you know? And maybe they hit it, maybe they don't. You know? But the thing is, they get very worried about outcome, you know. And they're not, of course, the more you do that kind of thing, the less natural you become. You lose confidence in the situation. There's a wisdom to the situation unfolding. And when you lose confidence, it can be quite devastating, you know. In Zen practice, people go through this too with their practice. You know, you'll be in a slump, you know, and it's just like baseball. You know, hitters have slumps. In anything in life, you can go into a slump. You know, it just happens sometimes. You know, you get into a slump and things just aren't connecting. And you can let it get you down, but, you know, in Zen, we learn how to deal with slumps. We learn how to, you know, you come in and you sit on the cushion and sometimes it's like, oh, that was wonderful. And sometimes it's like, you don't hit the ball, you know? You're at the plate for three sits and no hit, you know? That kind of thing happens in anything. It happens in science, it happens in research, it happens in business, you know? Things are just, you know, somebody was telling me the other day that, you know, Johnson & Johnson company is a very well-run company, but their stock has been in the basement for a long time. And he said, you know, basically their stock is going to come out of the basement one of these days because they're such a good company. And the thing is, you know, that'll happen. Meanwhile, the president of Johnson & Johnson could be chewing his fingernails every day, right? But that's not a very good way to live. You know, you have to realize that you can't necessarily make things happen. All you can do is be available, right? And people can be very good at being available. You know, I think we can be more creative when we're not afraid, you know, when we're not afraid of the outcome. We can be more creative. And also, we can be more creative if we try, but we don't care too much, you know. So you are going to make mistakes. We are going to make mistakes in our life. There's no way around it. Actually, from the Zen standpoint, there are no mistakes. You know, there's just things that happen. Mistakes is just a word. But when things don't go the way we plan, we call that a mistake sometime. But we just have to, you know, just have to be patient and be in the moment. And something is, you know, you're going to hit the ball one day, yeah? And it'll be wonderful. But you just have to not care too much, or you get tight and tense, and you lose trust in the situation. Kyosei asked a monk, "What is the noise outside?" The monk said, "That is the voice of the raindrops." Now, actually, you know, that's the koan, the voice of the raindrops, right? You know, when we hear, if you're a normal sort of human being, you might not hear the voice of the raindrops. You might have the TV on, or you might be listening to the radio, or, you know, you might have none of those things, but you might be so deep in your thoughts you're not present in the moment, you know? And basically, this person's, you know, present in the moment, you know, really present. And when you're present in the moment, you know, everything is alive, you know? So you're attentive, and you're caring, but not too much, right? You know, and so you sit in samadhi and you hear the sound of the rain, and that, as you know from Sesshin, if you were at the last Sesshin, that's the most beautiful experience, right? To be in deep samadhi and hear the rain, it's just like so gorgeous because the boundary between yourself and the world is gone, and it's, you are the rain, you know? And that's like a heavenly experience, you know? And life can be like that if we are in the right mind, if we're attentive, but we have the uwe spirit, you know? We're not holding on, expecting a result. So actually, this guy's answer is very good, you know, very good. Kyosei asked a monk, what is the noise outside? The monk didn't go, huh? What? Noise? He said, oh, that's the voice of the raindrops. He's deep in samadhi. Right? Kyosei said, men's thinking is upside down. Deluded by their own selves, they pursue things. Now, that's kind of like saying to the monk, challenging the monk, or calling into question what he just said. The monk was actually doing everything just right, you know. But this kind of, maybe it was meant to test him, to maybe shake up his confidence, you know. And so the monk says, what about you? And Kyosei said, I was near it, but I am not deluded. The monk said, what do you mean by near it but not deluded? And then Kyosei gives this fancy answer. He says, to say it in the sphere of realization may be easy, but to say it in the sphere of transcendence is difficult. Well, I think realization and transcendence are, first of all, the monk was doing everything right. The challenge sort of maybe was meant to shake him, you know, to shake his confidence a little bit. But the monk doesn't seem to be shaken in his confidence, I think, you know, and that's good. Maybe he's done a lot of zazen. But anyway, Kyosei is trying to make a point about how to practice, how to live, right? And the art of living well is about a realization and is transcendence, right? Realization means being here now, right? Being here now. And transcendence doesn't mean not being here now, see? Normally, you know, when people come in here for the introductory class on meditation, I always say, we're not going to enter a trance and go to a higher level and transcend life. I always say that's not Buddhism. Buddhism is not about that transcendence. That transcendence from the Buddhist standpoint is an illusion. So what kind of transcendence is he talking about? Well, he's talking about not caring too much about the outcome, right? Be here now, and then don't care too much about the outcome. If you care too much about the outcome, you become paralyzed and a prisoner of your fears. This is quite easy to do. And in fact, you know, when people lose all interest in their work, it's because they haven't been able to overcome their fear, you know. When people lose interest in what they're doing, it's because they've become too afraid of making mistakes. You know, that's happened to me. It can happen to anybody. When you become too afraid of making mistakes, it takes the joy out of what you do. And it's hard to recover that joy or that trust, you know. But you have to, you know, if you do zazen, if you enter a mushin and you try to sort of like have a mushin attitude in your work, you might rediscover what you love about it, you know. And it's hard, you know, it's hard. Because when we feel we're not succeeding, when we feel we're being criticized or failing, we lose our confidence. And that's difficult to recover. But the secret is really in our state of mind, you know? Having a trusting mind means having an empty mind, right? So you try, but you let go. And that's hard, I know. There's a wonderful story in the Tibetan tradition about Marpa and Milarepa, which you may have heard. But Marpa was a teacher of Milarepa, and Milarepa was a very crude-spirited person. And when he was like a bad person, really, Milarepa. He killed somebody using magical powers. And even though a person he killed sort of had done bad deeds too, he had gotten caught up in anger and killed somebody. Anyway, Milarepa was in hell because he was so unhappy, and he went to see Marpa. Marpa was actually a doctor, believe it or not. Marpa was a physician and meditation teacher. And he took Milarepa as his student with great reluctance. He said, I don't know, you're a very rough character, you know. And he said, I'll take you as my student, but I have great reluctance, you know. So he took him on, but he'd give him jobs to do. Like he'd say, listen, I want you to take all of the stones in this field and I want you to make a pile out of those stones. And don't talk to me until you're done. Yeah. And so Milarepa had to really work hard, you know, lifting these big stones and putting them in a pile. And basically, it was hell, you know, really hard work. And Marpa came out and looked and said, okay, now I want you to put them all back where they were, you know. And Milarepa thought, what the hell? You know, he got really mad. You know, I had to cast a spell on you, you know. But he thought, well, but I'm in such hell, I won't kill him, you know. Maybe you can help me get out of hell. So he took the rocks and put them all back. And the next day, you know, Marpa, or next time they met, Marpa had another task like that. He said, I want you to take these blocks and build this house, you know. Build a house, and there were these bricks, and you know, days and days went by, and Milarepa built the house, and then Marpa came by and said, "Okay, now I want you to take it to pieces. Take the sledgehammer, just knock it to pieces." So you know, this is really like a very good lesson, you know, because it's easy to forget this, but you know, when Milarepa was asked to take the stones and make a pile out of them, he didn't care. But as he did it, he began to care, you know. And then by the end, you know, probably when Marpa came to look, he was probably proud of what he had done. He probably felt, I done it. Look, I got every last stone in this field. You know? And Marpa just says, please, take them back. And it's like, oh, you know, that's, oh, that hurts so much. I cared so much about this, and now it's all thrown away. Second time, you know, he built this house. I'm sure he didn't care. But, you know, after he spent a day building it, bet he cared. Bet he wanted the bricks to be straight, you know, wanted to look, step back and thought, gee, that looks pretty good, you know. And then Marpa comes in and says, take it all apart. You know? And this goes on and on. And, you know, finally, Milarepa is ready to blow his brains out, you know, he's so unhappy. And he talks to Marpa's wife, and he says, I'm so unhappy, you know. And she says, look, you know, he's actually trying to help you. Well, it's really liberating, right, actually, to go through that process, even though we hate it. Because, you know, you get into, you either blow your brains out, or you get into a state where you realize the outcome is not the important thing. You know, it's not the important thing. It's what I was trying to do. And actually, if you worry about outcomes, you drive yourself crazy because they're really uncontrollable, right? I mean, you can be the best painter in the United States, and nobody might ever know your work. You know, that's so I know people like that. They do beautiful work, and they're just overlooked. And it's quite rare, actually, to be in a situation where your good work will be appreciated by others. Actually, that's quite rare, or where people will go, well done. You know, well done. Generally speaking, we don't get that kind of approval from others. But anyway, whether we do or not, you know, if we care too much about the outcome, we become paralyzed, and it poisons the atmosphere. So it's very important to cultivate, you know, this spirit of trying but not trying. You know, after Marpa asked Milarepa again and again to do things, and only to tear them to pieces, you know, he set Milarepa free. Now, Milarepa didn't leave and go, that's it, I'm not helping anybody ever again. He became a truly generous person. And that generosity can be cultivated in our daily lives as well as on the cushion, you know. Are you doing this to be, ultimately, you do what you do to be helpful to others and as a kind of giving of yourself. And it's very hurtful when people criticize us or don't appreciate what we do. And it's also very hurtful when we fail, when things don't go the way we want. But it's very important to remember that you were doing what your motive was, you know, what was your motive? Your motive was, even if you didn't know it, was a kind of selfless giving. Right? I mean, people are happiest when they're selflessly giving. And I mean, let's say we work for a check, but happy people don't work for their check. They work for the opportunity to be helpful to others. And that's the most important thing if you want to be happy. So, anyway, today we all came here to practice Zen, and I'm very happy to see all of you, and I hope you had a good sit. You don't always hit the ball when you come up to the plate, but sometimes you do, and it's great, right? So, this was a beautiful experience, and I look forward to our next chance to sit together.